You can hear me. Am I now? How's this? Oh, I can hear me now. Well, what can I tell you? I cannot believe that I am standing here. I mean, OMG. I just find it hard. I mean, gosh. I've been in this program a long time, and I love it. But one thing that I want you men to know is that I am afraid. I'm afraid of men. And I do want to thank Mike for asking me to speak. And that was very kind of you. Gave me 2 months to think about it. But I'm here and I'm ready to tell you about my story. And I want to tell you about the path that alcoholism has taken throughout my life. If I go like this, you can't hear me, right? So I have to stay this way. Oh, dear. Okay. And I'm going to start before I was born and kind of run it through to today. And, well, my grandmother was 19 years old when she married my grandfather, and he was 39 years old. And this was a long time ago. And I was told that, because my grandmother must have been having a good time when he wasn't there, that she drove him to drink. You know? I don't know. But they had one child who was my father. And my grandmother did divorce my real grandfather. And I think I only saw him 2 times. But I want you to know something. I'll just make a little side step here. About a year ago, I was looking for a big book in my house. And I could not find it. And then all of a sudden, I looked at this in this bookcase and I thought, that looks like a big book, but it's so old. I pulled it out and looked at it. It was my grandfather's. From 1946. And I was just, what a gift to get. And he had my birthday, my sister's birthday, and my father's birthday. And that was really lovely for me to see that. It's totally unexpected. But anyway, back to my grandmother divorced him, and my grandmother doted on my father. She really doted on him and mothered him a little bit too much. And as he got to be a young teenager, she had married another man who unfortunately was jealous of my father. And they had bought this house, big house in Santa Monica, and my step-grandfather had dug out under the house two little sort of apartments. My sister referred to them as the hellhole. My oldest sister, I have another sister, and my father was told he had to live down there. And there wasn't even cement on the floor, it was just dirt. And I've been thinking about this, that what must have gone on in his mind when my grandmother allowed that to happen. And so my father found his way down to Santa Monica Pier, and he met a man that I always knew as Uncle Jim, and he sort of took my father under his wing. And he brought him home, and I guess he might have stayed there too. And years later, I realized that he liked young boys. So my father had this stuff going on with him in his head. Mother, you know, who doted on him and then turned her back. And this other man who was very kind and loving to him. You know, it's like I tried to figure out what was it that made my father become so sick. I know there was a lot of rage at women. And, you know, my father, he did grow up, he got married, and he and my mom had my oldest sister and then me. And my mother had had a child before she married my father, and that was my oldest brother. And my mother's had four marriages. She had one child with the first, two with the second, one with the third, and two with the fourth. And she left everyone behind except the last two. And she knew what my father was like. She knew he was violent. She knew he drank all the time, all the time. And we ended up in that cellar, my sister and I and my father. My father slept in the kitchen, and my sister and I slept in the little front room, which had a trundle bed with one small mattress. And my sister and I each took a week. One week I slept on the springs, and she got the mattress. And then it was reversed the next week, and it worked out fine. I did not mind sleeping on the springs. But it was not a safe place for me with this raging, very ill, alcoholic father. My mother had, like I said, she went and moved on and had another family. And, you know, we were dirt poor. And, you know, there wasn't any activities or anything for my sister and I. You know, from a very, very early age, our job was to do the laundry, clean the place, do the shopping, do the grocery shopping, and the cooking and cleaning up, everything. That was what we did, my sister and I, while my father just sat around. And there was just a lot of fear with him. You know, he always had alcohol in his body, always. You know, if he was sitting in his overstuffed chair, the brown paper bag with the bottle of whiskey was there. If he was in the car, it was tucked down in the side, next to him in bed. You know, and, you know, he did to me the things that were done to him, you know, being abused. My oldest brother had been abused by him, and that oldest brother also abused me. Needless to say, my self-esteem was almost nil. I felt like a little rotted string that was just oozing out pain, insecurity, you know, fear every day of my life. Fear. And that's how I was growing up. I used to go out and do a lot of walking because I didn't want to be there. And I did have freedom. And so I'd go out walking. And on this one occasion, I was out walking. I wasn't even 10 years old yet. And some man asked me to come over to his car. And being a polite person, I walked over, and he started asking me the names of streets. And, you know, I didn't know. What did I know? Well, then I realized he was exposing himself to me. And so as soon as I realized that, I ran home. And I told my stepsister. And she told her mother. And the worst words that I could hear growing up was, "Charlene, come here." So I went in, and he said, "Did you get his license number?" And I said, "No." And he screamed at me and slapped me across the face. Now, when you would think, as a small child, you know, when something so traumatic happens, that you would try to comfort that child. But I didn't get comfort. I got abused. And later on, years later, I realized why. I figured why. Because my father had been arrested for exposing himself to some girls. So, you know, you can kind of understand where all this goes. You know, I moved on into high school and very poor, very poor. And I went to Santa Monica High School, which has a lot of wealthy people. Back then it didn't, I'm sure it does now. I certainly was not one of them. I grew up, for the most part, three blocks from the ocean. And I could hear the waves at night. I could smell the ocean, and I could hear the foghorn. Those were pleasant memories for me as a child. And my grandmother still lived upstairs with my step-grandfather, and we were down in the cellar. By the time my sister and I moved down there, we didn't have cement on the floor, so we didn't have just dirt. So, you know, we went about our life day after day, you know, doing what little girls do, except for the times when I would hear my father say, "Charlene, come here." And the terror would rise. And as I got a little bit older, I started to develop fears, irrational kind of fears. And the only way that I could get to sleep at night was to fantasize about decorating a home. I'm artistic, I love to decorate, paint, and so that was one way I was able to get to sleep as a small child, because I don't know what was going to happen. So I, what happened? Thank you, Jack, to the rescue. Oh.
Hopefully.
Okay. If not, I can speak louder. So, those were kind of the way the years were for me. And I got through them. I really did. With a very low self-esteem. Like I said, I was like this little pathetic string, kind of rotted. Just oozing out of me was pain, fear, shame, guilt for what? I don't know. But that was who I was back then. I didn't have many friends in high school. And the one friend I did feel was my best friend, she would hide from me. She would hide because she didn't want to hang around this pathetic piece of string. She wanted to go have fun and do things. So, you know, I just kept going and kept going and kept going and living my life to the best of my ability. I've always been an optimist. And, you know, when I turned 17, I graduated from high school, and within 3 weeks I went to beauty school. And because we were so poor, you know, you wonder where did the money come from. That grandfather that I talked about with the big book, he passed away and half of his estate went to my sister and I. And I was able to take some of that money and pay for a beauty college and go, which is what I did. And when I turned 18, I moved out. And within a very short period of time, I met him, my him. And I think I knew him about 3.5 months when we were married. And I knew life would be good. I knew life would be good. And he was working, he had a job. You know, and he wanted to go to college, and he was a little older than I, he'd been in the Army, so he was able to go to college, and he graduated in 3.5 years, 4.0, summa cum laude, very brilliant man, and he worked full time. So he took like 18 units at a time and worked full time. And he just really was a brilliant man, and you know, I just knew, because he was always gone, you know, he was either in school, But I later found out it was also in a bar. You know? Sound familiar to some folks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's from Pittsburgh. Now, I don't know if there's a lot of people from that part of the country, but there's a bar here, and a bar here, and a church in the middle. Right? I mean, me coming from Santa Monica, you know, I was fascinated by this. And my husband's favorite bar was John's Bar in Pittsburgh. I don't know if there's anyone here who's from Pittsburgh or been to John's Bar. But back then, women were not allowed in the front of the bar. There was a room in the back that women could go. You could get a, you know, a beer or whatever. And I think that's changed now. But but my husband, you know, I found out that he went to the bar. His life was in a bar. That's just who he was. And I remember meeting a bartender once that, because my husband happened to bring me to the bar, and the guy had no clue that my husband was married. He never discussed me. He was shocked that my husband was married. And he said, you know, Frank can talk to anybody. He can talk to the guy who picks up your trash or the brain surgeon. He can talk to anybody. And he loved to stand at the bar and talk and drink. Politics, whatever. It didn't make any difference. He loved it there. And you know, when I very first came into program, I tried three times. It took unbelievable horror to get me to be willing to stay in this program. And what was I saying about that? I know the first time I went to an Al-Anon meeting, two of my husband's friends took me. And one, I think, was on drugs, and the other one was just a really lovely woman. And they were concerned about my husband because they thought he might have a drinking problem. And so I was told, I went with them, and we went into this meeting, and they started reading a book. And all I thought was, no, I can't read in public. You'll find out how dumb I am. Because I also, growing up in that world that I grew up in, I felt stupid. I felt I had no abilities. I had nothing to offer anyone. That's how I feel. Just a nothing. You know, I remember a girlfriend, her mother called me poor white trash. You know, and I thought, yeah, that fits. That fits. I'm nothing. And I'm stupid on top of it. You know, I mean, the damage that happens to us when we spend part of our life with alcoholics really does a number on us. It can destroy us, who we are meant to be. And for a long, long time, I was destroyed inside. I hurt. I had irrational fears. I was running to the doctor all the time because I imagined things wrong with me when there was nothing, nothing wrong. I remember one time going to see this doctor and he says, you're fine. And I left there, I felt euphoric. And then when I got in the car, I thought, maybe it's starting now. Maybe now it's starting. You know, crazy, crazy stuff. But that's my world at the time. I just, you know, I tried my best. And after my husband graduated college, we had two sons. And I love those boys, love them very, very much. They're wonderful men today. And, you know, our life kind of just moved on, you know, raising the boys. My husband's, he's never home. He's home on weekends. Now, my husband never drank at home, except if there was a party. So it wasn't like it was in my face. It was out at a bar somewhere, you know? And I know what I was going to say. I'll back up a little bit. When I was went to my very first, no, my second, my third Al-Anon meeting. It was, years went by. Now, the second time I went, I told my husband, if you don't stop drinking, I'm going to go to Al-Anon. I always get such a wonderful laugh when I say that. Well, I went, and I went for about 6 weeks. I remember Jack. Jack was there, and I think it was, yeah. Anyway, I didn't identify as a newcomer. I was so terrified of you. I mean, I couldn't trust anyone. I didn't trust people. I know you're gonna hurt me. You know, when I mentioned earlier about being afraid of men, that's from my father. I know, I love men. I think you're wonderful specimens. I just really do. And I'm very, very fortunate to have so many here just listening to me. Boy, am I lucky. So, oh, thank you. I have some down there. Thank you. Thank you, Jack. He's such a nice man. And so, finally, some years went by, and I was ready for this program. And it was after I'd been in therapy for several years with a psychiatrist at UCLA. And something happened, and I felt I needed to be hypnotized because I'd had this horrible nightmare. And I asked my doctor, could I be hypnotized, to find out, because I was stifled. I just couldn't move forward. And so finally she agreed, and she had a professor at UCLA who hypnotized me. And let's just say I went back to 3 years old, and it was a horrible, horrible thing that I was experiencing. And after that, I was in such a horrible mental place. I could barely get out of bed. I couldn't eat. I just couldn't eat. I couldn't put food in my mouth because I was so terrorized by what I experienced. And I realized that I brought up something so deep in me that I was not prepared to deal with. I had no clue. I do not recommend it for anyone. So for like 9 months, I just vegetated. My husband wasn't home. He didn't want to hear about any of this stuff. You know, that's why you go see the doctor. And so, you know, I thought about Al-Anon, and I thought, maybe that's what I need. And so I was willing to go. And I would go to what we call, out where we live, the cocoon at that time. And I'd go there, and it was very small, maybe 4 or 5 people, all women, most, I think always, you know, and during the day. And, you know, I started feeling a little better. And I noticed that when the meeting was going to be over, I started to get frightened, because it meant I had to go back out there where I didn't feel safe. My sons by this time were grown and married, and of course my husband wasn't home, you know? And so I kept going. And then someone said, you know, there's other meetings in our valley, which I didn't know. So someone said, over at the hospital. So that night I went over to the hospital and I walked into the entrance. And I knew the room, but the door was shut. Oh my gosh, the door was shut. I have to open that door. Oh my gosh. I mean, all this fear in me, but I thought, I've got to do this. So I turned the knob, opened the door, it was packed. But there was one lady who winked at me, and I thought, it's okay. And so I have been coming now for almost 26 years, and I have grown. I am not that same person I was, because you have taught me. You have really taught me. When I sit in a room, I don't usually raise my hand, but I listen with my ears and I listen to what people are saying. And I realize I am not alone. That a lot of you have those same feelings. Unwanted, unloved, and alone. You know, all those things that we learn as we come to program. And then we learn the hope. You know, there is hope in these rooms. And I am so blessed that I am willing to do whatever it takes to get myself in a better place. And so I just keep coming and I keep coming. And you know, the years have gone by and I've gone through going to woman and being the dancer in front, me? Jeez Louise. I mean, I'm very shy. You know, I really am. And for me to be standing here is just amazing. And I really thank you all for being here. I'm not through. You know, I still have more to say. And so, life moved on and moved on. And I noticed my husband was not coming home. He was coming home a little bit more often. You know, because before that, for years, my husband got up in the morning, showered, got dressed, made some funny story up and told me, make me laugh, kissed me goodbye, and went out the door. And I felt so good. But as the night started to come, and he didn't come home, and he didn't come home, and he didn't come home. And then I would go to bed, and about between 2 and 5 in the morning, he'd come home. Night after night after night after night after month, year, that's what he did. And I'd say, you know, don't you finish your work? Shawnee, my work's never done. You know, I didn't realize that there was a bar downstairs from the building he was in. You know, duh. You know, I learned to cope. And one reason people might have said, well, why didn't you leave him? He was my world. He was my mother. He was my father. He was my whole family. I looked to him to help me with everything. You know, he wasn't a demonstrative man. He was not. He had walls built up around him. Walls. I couldn't get close. I could not get close to him as much as I wanted. You know, I used to say to him, do you love me? And his response would be, what's love, Charlene? You know, that's not what I want to hear. You know, I want to say, yes, I love you. You know, but it's who he was, you know. And he's a good man. He loved his kids very much. And we have 5 grandkids. And oh, how he loved those children. He loved them so much. And they loved him. We used to go to our kids' softball games. And when we would get there, the little ones would run because they'd see us pass me by, run and say, Papa! And they'd run and pick them up, and he had suckers for them. I mean, he just loved them to death. And they, you know, felt the same. And it was really quite lovely. And then, like I said, my husband was home a little bit more after all these years. And I didn't understand because he never talked about his work. I don't know how much money he made. You know, I'd ask him and he'd tell me a story, you know, which didn't answer my question, you know. It's just the way it was. And I knew not to ask a lot of things, and I knew to be very thoughtful with him. I shared this the other day. Excuse me. Years ago, when I was relatively new in program, I learned right away do not get in other people's business. And I knew my husband was a very proud man. And we were at a restaurant, and we ordered our meal, and his came with soup. And when they brought the milk, they did not bring his soup. So me, Miss Al-Anon, I said, "You didn't bring his soup." My husband was furious with me. I saw the anger just come over him. I was not to speak for him. Now, that may be crazy to some of you that are married. What difference does it make? But in my marriage, you didn't do that. And so what I learned in this program was, when you make a mistake, you acknowledge it. You make an amends immediately. And so I said, "You know, you're right. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have done that." It changed the whole dimension. He was fine, and we had a lovely dinner together. So, you know, that really stuck in my mind, that this is what, you know, it's all about. You know, to be able to acknowledge when you've done something wrong, to say it, you know, and don't say, you know, "I'm sorry, but," you know, because to me that cancels it out. You know, just say, "I am really sorry. I should not have done that." And, you know, he was, he was just terrific. You know, he was very witty and funny, and so one day, 2002, he's not getting up for work. I'm getting up, and he says, "Don't get up yet." And so I said, "What?" And I got so terrified, because I was always afraid he was going to die. I mean, of course, we all die, but I thought, he's going to tell me he's dying. And so he said, "Charlene, I've done something illegal. I've turned myself in, and I am going to prison." And I thought, oh my gosh. You know, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, he was so highly respected in his profession. Highly respected. He had an FBI clearance. I mean, he worked with the court systems. And he was so highly regarded. So he said, "I'm going away soon." And he says, "We may have to sell our home." And I thought, oh, because the home that we lived in and I live in now is that home I decorated every night as a little girl. I decorated that home, and that's where I live today. And so, you know, I said, "Well, I guess I can't get my nails done." He said, "No." "We have to stop the gardener." "Yes." You know? But what he did was, he accounted for every single solitary penny that was missing or misplaced or whatever. And not one single solitary penny went to us. We didn't have fancy cars. We didn't go on trips. You know, he accounted for it. He, because he worked with the courts, a situation arose where he was supposed to be paid a huge sum of money, and someone other than my husband made a big mistake, and the judge was so angry, he said, "Nobody's getting paid." Well, my husband needed to pay his people that worked for him, and it just went from there. You know? And so, you know, he says, "We may have to sell our home." And I, oh. But someone in program had told me, she had lost her husband and she had lost her home. And she said to me, "Charlene, I would rent out every room in my house and I would have slept on the floor to save my home." And I thought, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I rented out rooms in my home. I had two Japanese girls and one Russian girl. Now Marty's laughing. Yes, it was funny. The culture, you know, these girls had just come from their countries, and it was very difficult for me. I hadn't been working, so I had to go out and get a job, and so being as stupid as I thought I was and all those kind of things, what can I do? I thought the only thing I can do is clean hotel rooms. You know, I can do that. I know how to make a bed and I know how to clean a toilet. Yeah, I could do that. But someone said, a dear friend told me that at the senior center, you can go there and put your name on a list and you get called for jobs. So that's what I did. And I did that for a year, and I was working quite a bit. And I'd come home proud of myself, and I worked very, very hard. I worked two different jobs for a while. And I hadn't done hair. I did get my license, but I hadn't done hair in over 30 years. And a dear friend of mine, who isn't here tonight because she's back east, she called up this assisted living facility that's right near my house. They were building it, wasn't finished. She went in and told them, or asked them, do you have a beautician? They said, no. She said, I know of one. And they said, well, have her come in. Now mind you, I'm dumb as dirt. I'm nothing but a pathetic string with pain, not as much since I got into program. So I went and I met them, and they thought I'd be wonderful. And I worked at that beauty shop for 15 years. I retired a year ago. And I remember the first day I drove there. It was only 2 miles from my house. And I was just freaking out. But I thought, you can do this, Charlene. You can do this. And I did. And you know what's so wonderful? I got my license in the 60s. The people in those that came to my shop, perfect. I could do their hair like you can't imagine. No teasing, spray, no round brush. You know, just, you know. And I also would Al-Anon them. I would Al-Anon them, you know, as they tell me things. You know, there were these two Italian women who hated each other. I did both of them. They never were in the same room together. And they were very religious. And they would each come, when they'd come, they'd bitch to me about each other. And I said to both of them at different times, what would God have you do? You know? What would God have you do? They just couldn't accept that. One just kept making more excuses than the other one, you know? So, okay. That's all right. You know, I did what I thought I should do. And I remember one gentleman who, which time do I have left? Oh, I'm getting close. Anyway, This man said to me, you are one of the last few pleasures I have in life, because I would cut his hair. So gentle and kind I was with these people. Now, I'm going to rush through the last part. March 30th, 2002, I was going to my mother's 80th birthday party with my husband, ironic, driving up to Lancaster to celebrate her birthday. And we were in a car accident. I was driving and my husband was killed. And my life changed that day forever. And, you know, this program, this program has helped me so much. I am blessed beyond words about what you've done for me. You know, all the people that came to the funeral, and in an afternoon, they took off work to come to the funeral. And I remember seeing Jack there. And, You know, I was just amazed. I didn't think anybody, you know, would care enough about me, you know? I just didn't think that. But you all surprised me. And I've been coming and coming to these meetings for years now, finding answers, learning about myself. And I mean, I'm just so, I'm proud of myself. That dumb little piece of string that I talked about, you know, on Wednesdays I go to an English as a second language class and I'm helping. I'm helping these people, these wonderful people who want to improve themselves. And I can do that. And when the last session ended, they gave us gifts, and this one woman said that I was charismatic. You know how far I have come. Can you understand how far I have come? I am not that same person. My friend Marty, when she first saw me many years back, she said she thought I looked like Mrs. Beaver Cleaver. I would have never thought that about myself, you know? Never. But I am me. I'm a whole person now. And I live a good life. I'm retired, and so I volunteer my time different places. And I have a huge amount of friends. No longer do I have that one friend who used to hide from me. You know, it just, I'm blessed. I am so blessed. And about a year ago, my youngest son, he had some problems. And he came over and asked me to help him. And we made a deal. I said, I'll help you, but you have to go to Al-Anon. I'd asked him before, and he said, Mom, I'll do anything you want, but not that. And so this time he said, sure, I'll go. And it's been going for almost a year now. And I'm so proud of him. I mean, he's not afraid to stand up and talk. He's not afraid to raise his hand and say something. And he's the media guy, and he changed the whole media thing around. And they've made a lot of money because of what he did. I'm just really proud. And a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, he's so nice. You know, I sure like him. And last week I was at a meeting, a speaker meeting, and there was a man, a gentleman, who spoke. And afterwards I went up to him, and I thanked him and hugged him, and he said, I sure like your son. I said, thank you. He says, he's really a nice guy. I said, well, thank you. He says, and he loves you very much. He says, you know how I know that? I says, no. He says, because it's how I loved my mother. And I just, wow, what gifts there are in these rooms. You don't have to volunteer all the time. It's nice to, but come and listen. Listen to what we're saying. There is hope. I mean, I'm going through my second steps. I'm on the fourth, and I have learned so much about me. This is the latest thing that I've learned, that when I see someone who is unpleasant to me and I don't know them, or if I do know them, they're unpleasant, I realize it's not them, it's that little child inside them that's coming up for whatever reason, what's been triggered in them. I know in me there is a small child who gets triggered easily. You know, for me it's post-traumatic stress disorder. That's something that affects me, but not like it used to. Not like it used to, because I understand so much more. And I am so grateful. I mean, don't you feel grateful too? Don't you feel it? You come in these rooms and you feel and hear the things you want to hear and need to hear. You know, I don't have to go back to that damn cellar. You know? Now I have my older sister who was in program for about 4 or 5 years. And every week she raised her hand and she talked about the bad stuff. Every week. And she was of service, but she could not get past the bad stuff to see there is possibilities. So she stopped coming. And a few years later, I got a call, and she had slit her throat and her wrist severely. She cut her tongue. And she was rushed to the emergency room. And I talked to an Al-Anon who was emergency room nurse who was trying to hold the blood, and she said, "She's trying to hold the blood in." You know? And I couldn't believe it. It was so traumatic. And I remember going in, she had a respirator on, and she's just saying, "I want to die. I mean, you know, I want to die. Please let me die. Please let me die." You know, I mean, it just, it's heartbreaking. And I, you know, she got better, and they took the feeding tube out, and she can eat. And, you know, all she can think about is the bad. She can't get beyond it. She's very sick, and the gentleman talked about mental illness. Yes, my sister is mentally ill, and it's heartbreaking. I have to keep my distance from her, because she takes me down with her. And I have to protect myself. I have to take care of, number one, me. That's what you've taught me, that I have to take care of me, because nobody else's, you know? It's nobody else's business but me to take care of myself. And, you know, I just have to let her be. She has a husband, and actually, she calls my kids and they go over and help her with things. You know, and I'm very happy that they do. She can drive them crazy. She really can. She's excessive compulsive, extreme. You know, but that's just how it is. So I want you to know, and this is the last thing I'll say, my husband, after he died, he had an attorney, and $3 million is what he was missing. But it didn't go to, like I said, us. It went from this to pay that over many years. And after he died, I was told the government forgave the $3 million. Now that is a blessing beyond blessings, because I would have been left with that. But there's nothing. I am here today to tell you, you can get through a lot of bad stuff and just know that there is hope. I mean, God knows I've been through a lot, but I'm here to tell you life is good, and thank you.